Welcome to Season 11 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm. We manage approximately $150 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional and individual investors. That capital is invested across private and public credit strategies. Each week, I sit down with key relationships to and partners of the firm to learn from their experience, ask how that experience shapes their current roles, and give insights into HPS and how we operate. So with that, let's bring in our guest. Our guest this week is a Hollywood development executive who, in 2005, founded The Blacklist, an enterprise that now does many things, but at its core is a yearly listing of the best unproduced screenplays of the year. He graduated from Harvard and spent some time working as a management consultant for McKinsey before making the move to Hollywood to work in development. In 2005, while working at Appian Way Productions, Leonardo DiCaprio's company, he came up with the idea to survey execs on their 10 favorite scripts they'd read that had yet to be bought or optioned, and then shared that list with the survey respondents. From that humble beginning, The Blacklist has become an annual institution, with more than 1,000 scripts having been featured. Of those, over 400 have reached the screen, representing over $30 billion of box office and a remarkable 50 Academy Awards won. I think a great way to sum up The Blacklist legacy is the title of our guest's fantastic TED Talk, How I Accidentally Changed the Way Movies Get Made. So without any further ado, I'm thrilled to welcome in this week's HPS cast guest, Franklin Leonard, CEO and founder of The Blacklist. Franklin, welcome to the pod.
Thank you for having me.
Franklin, I want to go all the way back. Where'd you grow up? Where are you from originally?
I was an Army brat. I was born in Hawaii. We moved around a lot when I was a kid because my dad would just get stationed in a new place like every 12 to 24 months. But I grew up primarily in Columbus, Georgia, which is about 2 hours south of Atlanta on the Alabama border. We moved back there from Germany when I was about 8 when my dad's mom died and he got stationed at what was then Fort Benning. And yeah, that was, you know, I was a black nerd in the deep south while Steve Urkel was on television. It was not the best thing in the world for my social life.
All is well that ends well, though, Franklin. All right, so you attended Harvard undergrad. Tell us about why that was the right choice for you out of high school.
For a black nerd in the deep south, Harvard was this like shining beacon of like, this is what is possible, right? It's the best, the quote unquote best school. And really, whatever I decided that I was interested in, whatever I decided I wanted to pursue long term, there was some way to go deep in that thing at Harvard and be among the best at that thing. And so for me, it was, you know, okay, if I can just get here, this will be a launch pad to everything else. And I think that largely proved to be true. I mean, I think academically, I think the university sort of speaks for itself, but obviously like a significant part of a Harvard education is the people that you meet while you're there and the opportunities that those relationships create for better or worse, right?
So tell me, you were a social studies major, a name that minimizes a fairly intense amount of coursework, as was I, by the way. What specifically did you study your concentration? How did you spend your time academically in college?
It's interesting. So I was on the literary magazine. I was on The Advocate. And so a lot of my electives and sort of non, you know, mainline social studies courses were things that were focused on either politics and sort of like, you know, community activism. I think that was my junior seminar, if I remember correctly. Or they were focused on literature and sort of the notion of storytelling and culture. Like I remember really loving, there was a course that I took, I guess my freshman or sophomore year, called The Meanings of Abstraction in 20th Century Art. And so I was really interested in the interaction between culture and politics and culture and society and the ways in which culture kind of lives upstream from the politics of the day.
So Franklin, as you're graduating, what did you think you wanted to do first?
My junior year, I took a course in the history of the Supreme Court under Earl Warren, Warren Court, sort of famously titled. And my teaching assistant for that class decided to run for Congress in Cincinnati, Ohio in the 2000 cycle, which was the year that I graduated. And he asked me to help move out to Cincinnati and help run his campaign. I'd always been interested in politics. So the day after I graduated, I drove to Cincinnati, Ohio and lived there for 6 months and helped him run his campaign. That race was covered by MTV News as part of a new series they were doing that was True Life, I'm a Candidate. And him being the youngest congressional challenger in the country, you know, we were sort of a natural race for them to cover. I was asked to come audition to be a VJ. That went terribly. I had gotten a traveling fellowship from Harvard. I moved to Trinidad. I wrote for the Guardian newspapers for 6 months in Trinidad. And then I moved to New York and accepted the job that I had been offered the year prior at McKinsey as a business analyst. And as it happened, when I arrived at McKinsey & Company, Michael Wolff had left Booz Allen and Hamilton, where he was running the global media practice, to take over the global media practice at Booz. And for whatever reason, he sort of took me under his wing and made me his like mentee. And that was the beginning of my trajectory towards like the business of media and entertainment.
You know, were you personally a movie buff as a kid? Like, talk to me about then sort of that we're going to get to Hollywood eventually, right? But like, why media? Yeah.
I don't know that I would have described myself as a movie buff as a kid. I just think that I had no social life and there weren't a lot of social outlets to like on your own in Columbus, Georgia, other than going to the movies. So I think there was probably a period from like 1992 when my parents were finally comfortable letting me go to the movies alone till I graduated high school, where I probably saw every major studio release in the theater because what else was I going to do, right? But it never occurred to me to pursue a career in film and television because growing up in West Central Georgia, especially as a black kid in West Central Georgia, it would have been more likely that I could have been an astronaut and gone to the moon because I was really good at math and a decent soccer player, so I was a decent athlete. I had a better chance of going to NASA than I did figuring out a way to navigate to Hollywood. And the only reason I was able to is because I had a set of social relationships that began at Harvard that, you know, got me my first interview at Hollywood when I finally made the move out there after being at McKinsey.
So before we leave McKinsey, I always think, you know, these early jobs are formative on some level. What lessons do you take with you from your McKinsey days?
I think a lot. I think I took a lot of lessons around how to be a good corporate team player, like what it means to be a part of a team in a corporate environment, how you can disagree without being disagreeable, how to make a data-driven argument. I think that's something that I have an instinct for generally, but I think, you know, you make enough decks and you get enough feedback on decks and try to explain, this is what I believe about the world and this is why. I think that, you know, that was a skill that I definitely developed there. I also think just a capacity for work. You know, one of the things that I realized when I came out to Hollywood, I had an interview, my first job as an assistant at CAA, and my boss was like, listen, I work really late hours. Like sometimes I'm here till 8 p.m. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do with the extra hours that I now have, right? Like just to give you some sense of what I think about in terms of a lot of work. So I think it was a lot of that. And look, The Blacklist, and we'll talk about this in a second, is really fundamentally that annual survey is just a McKinsey deck. So it's truly formative in the sense that like determined the direction of my long-term career, weirdly.
Okay, so you make the decision to go out to LA. You join CAA, one of the largest agencies in Hollywood. Talk to us about both the decision to do the Hollywood move and then also why CAA as an agency, why that was the first right step for you.
Yeah, so my analyst class got laid off with 5 months severance shortly after 9/11. And, you know, we continued to receive our severance as long as we didn't get another job. You know, we could do nonprofit work and continue to get our salaries. So I was doing a lot of like nonprofit arts consulting in Manhattan, but I was spending a lot of time just watching movies and reading about the film industry. I was living in Brooklyn. I would take the L train into Manhattan. I'd go to Kim's Video on St. Mark's. I'd go to the Barnes & Noble in Union Square and I'd read about the industry like it was a library. So, you know, and that was sort of my like heavy film education. And then I realized like, yeah, I've always loved movies. And there was a snowstorm in February of 2003 in New York. I think we got like 2.5 feet. And I remember watching Amadeus, Dr. Strangelove, and Being There back to back to back. And at the end of Being There, I remember looking out the window and like it was really cold and really snowy. I checked the temperature in LA. It was not really cold or really snowy. And I bought a round trip ticket for the month of March, not really knowing what I was going to do. And as it happened, my second night there, I had a drink with a friend of a friend of mine. She's like, oh, there's an agent at CAA who I think you get along with who's looking for an assistant. Let me pass your resume along, right? And this is what I meant in terms of that social network. And, you know, CAA is the biggest agency in the world. The agency assistant thing is considered to be the first step in launching your non-front-of-the-camera career in Hollywood. So I was like, yeah, I'll take the meeting. Had the interview, really hit it off with who became my eventual boss, a woman named Rowena Arguelles, who represents writers and directors. She offered me the job on a Friday, and I started on the following Monday.
That's awesome. All right, so what is that work? So you're your first foot in the door at CAA. What are you actually doing?
You're a secretary. You're answering phones. You're setting meetings. You're sending scripts via Messenger to clients, and you're listening into calls, and that's sort of where you get your best education about how the industry actually functions. And you're learning a lot about, you know, the different facets of the business and trying to figure out what it is that you want to do.
You know, I always feel like, you know, especially early in your career, there's so much learning by osmosis, and it's like the definition of that. You're just in it, you know, from the beginning. Okay, so you do that for a couple of years and then make the move to the development side. There's a bunch of different paths one can take through Hollywood. Why development? Why was that the right path for you?
You know, I think I didn't want to be an agent. I knew very early on, it might have just been that I didn't want to wear a suit every day, if I'm being honest about my level of maturity in my mid-20s. But, you know, development felt like the place where you were synthesizing creative, like the arts, you're like working with artists and you're also thinking seriously about the business of art. And that felt like the place where I felt like I was probably most valuable. And yeah, so I bounced around a bunch of development jobs. I worked for a producer named John Goldwyn. I worked for Leo's company for 2 years and had a series of jobs after that as I was sort of figuring out the long-term plan would be.
All right, well, let's talk about that long-term plan. I mentioned it at the beginning. When did you first have the idea? Like, what was the kernel of an idea that has now become what, you know, what the Blacklist is today?
You know, I think, so 2005, I'm a junior executive at Leonardo DiCaprio's production company. My job is to find good scripts and good writers. And I knew very early on in my career, my competitive advantage was never going to be like being the guy that was friends with a lot of actors or like was at the right clubs. Like I was going to be the guy who could read more than most. And so every weekend I would take home, you know, this is pre-iPad, I would take home a banker's box full of screenplays, plow through 20 of them, and then come in on Monday morning and my boss would ask me if I'd read anything that was worth his time. And most of the time the answer would be no. Because writing something that was so good that I could walk into his office and slap it down on the desk and say, this is the priority now, it's a hard thing to do, to write something that good. And so after a year or two of this, I had reached a point where I was like, okay, I must not be very good at my job if my job is finding good stuff. Or the job is just reading bad scripts and passing on them. Either way, my mother's weekly phone calls asking me if my LSAT scores were still valid is something I should take more seriously, right? And so I think I probably just defaulted to a lot of the thinking that I picked up at McKinsey. It's like, all right, your job is to find good scripts. Who has information about good scripts? Your peers who are doing the same job that you are. What if you just aggregated all of that information and put it into a consumable form, in this case, like a list of people's favorite stuff? And how can you incentivize people to participate in that information gathering? And I did it anonymously, but the premise was, send me a list of your 10 favorite unproduced screenplays. In exchange, I'll send you the combined list. And that was it. And, you know, again, I thought it was a very self-interested idea. And it was fundamentally a very self-interested idea. I didn't realize at the time that everybody was in that situation. Everybody was trying to find good material. And so I solved a bigger problem. And that first list went viral, you know, December of 2005. So this will be the 20th list. And yeah, you mentioned the numbers. It's pretty staggering. The one number that you didn't mention, and probably the one that I'm weirdly most proud of, Harvard Business School did a study on the annual Blacklist a couple years ago, right before the pandemic, and found that movies made from scripts on the annual Blacklist, controlling for all other factors, make 90% more in revenue than movies made from scripts not on the Blacklist, right? And I can't take credit for the movies that were made. I didn't make them. I didn't produce direct gaff. I didn't do craft service. I didn't make the food. But I think we, and I say we because we're a team of people now at the company, built a metal detector that finds needles in a very large stack of haystacks. And that's valuable, right? And it also proves the thesis that like the best business plan is a good screenplay. No matter what anybody tells you, writers are undervalued.
So let's talk about from those humble beginnings to what it is today. First of all, why did it go viral? Like when you look back, why do you think it exploded the way it did?
Because everybody's looking for good scripts. The most valuable thing is good material. And it was funny because I didn't fully appreciate the extent to which that was true. But in the years following the first list, I would meet people, like high-level industry people who were like very excited to meet me. And I was always very confused about why that was. And they were like, oh yeah, we have a group chat where all of us talk about the list every time it comes out. You know, they asked Meryl Streep about this movie that she's in, where did she find it? And she's like, there's this thing called The Blacklist. You know, that's probably one of the best days of my life. So I think I underestimated the extent to which that was true. And then I really realized the value of it when I got a phone call halfway through 2006 from an agent who was pitching me on a new client. And remember, I had made The Blacklist anonymously. So he's pitching me on a new client and ends the call by saying, look, don't tell anybody this, but I have it on good authority. This is going to be the number one script on next year's Blacklist. And I had decided not to do it again. Right? So like this guy was just straight up lying. But it made me realize that like if the speculative notion of a script ending up on the list was of value to an agent, then getting on the list must have had a lot of value. And so that was when I decided to do it again. I was unmasked as the person that created it by the LA Times shortly after the second list came out in early 2007. And then we've done it every year since.
I think it's fascinating what it's become. What is it today? Give people a sense who are less familiar what the Blacklist is today.
I would describe it as sort of a two-sided marketplace where on one side, writers can create a profile, sort of an IMDb page or like a Wikipedia page under their control that is free to create. You can also pay to host their scripts or pay for feedback from readers that we hire who have experience in the format in which the people are reading. And then on the other side of that marketplace is everybody who can do something with it. So directors, actors, producers, publishers, editors, agents, other writers, etc. And what we're trying to do is find the good stuff. You know, I think about it, if the annual list is sort of handheld metal detector with one giant haystack, this is an at-scale metal detector in an infinite field of haystacks, whose primary job is to find the things that people who are in these professional industries can do something with and make sure that they know about it. Like, presumably, if we recognize that, like, good material is the font from which all value in this business comes outside of unscripted, how are we finding the good writers? And people are like, you know, enter the Nickel Fellowship, the Academy Screenwriting Competition. If you place in the top 100, someone will probably call you. Otherwise, just move to LA, get a job at Starbucks, network until someone pays attention to you. And I think I'm probably sensitive to these kind of access issues just as a black kid from Georgia who managed to like figure it out because I was really good at math and got into Harvard and like put myself in this Whisper social network. But like, that's a little bit like saying, oh, you want to be an NBA player? Here's the thing. The NBA corporate headquarters is in New York City. Move to New York, play pickup ball at one of the basketball courts near the headquarters. Someone will probably see you. And if you're good enough, we'll then send you to a team, right? You're not going to get the best players because we don't get the best writers because you can't afford to move to LA or have the wherewithal to move to LA doesn't mean you're not a good writer, right? And yes, writers lose because of that access issue, but more importantly, the industry loses because we're not recruiting the best talent that we could then profit on. So the blacklist is like, how do you solve that problem? How do you find great writing wherever it is and then make sure that people can reach out to them if they live in Des Moines, Iowa or Texarkana, whatever, so that, you know, you don't have to move to LA just to have a shot at a career.
Well, and it's interesting. You said something once I thought was really interesting, which is there's a democratization, like there's a process by which this actually makes it impossible to be perfect, but makes it more of a meritocracy. And that's not only valuable, period, but that actually creates diversity, right? Like inevitably, you're going to have a much broader set of people then because that's just an inevitable byproduct of it. And that side impact, I think, is incredibly interesting in what you've done, Franklin.
That's the thing that, you know, people talk about democratization all the time. And I'm like, yeah, I think we're probably doing that. But the goal for me is meritocratization. How do we create a system where if you've got the goods, that's all that matters, right? And wouldn't it be amazing if you could stay wherever you are and be a great writer and the industry could find you and the industry could profit from your genius? Everybody wins. And selfishly, this is really just about me wanting to watch better movies and television. And so I had to build a system to make those things more likely.
Tell me about what's next. What are you excited about in the future, near term, for Blacklist?
I think the biggest thing, you know, just 2 weeks ago, we expanded the Blacklist website to fiction so that anybody who's written an English language novel, well, they can write a profile for free, but they can also upload their novel, purchase feedback on a 100-page excerpt, and if it's good or if our reader is enthusiastic about it, we will then tell everybody who's an industry member of our site and the publishing industry and the film industry and the television industry, like, hey, everybody, this is really good. You should probably do something with it. You know, there's a professor, I think she's at Temple, who found that over the last 5 years, the novels that have been published by the Big Five, there are more novels that are set in New York City than the next 30 largest American cities combined. That's not because all the best writers are only writing about New York, right? It's because the system that identifies value is not optimized, which is a very nerdy econ major way to describe it. But I think that's how I think about it. And that's probably the thing that's most exciting.
No, it's incredibly exciting. I love what you've built, Franklin. Tell me about your view of the industry more broadly. You know, it's been a volatile last couple of years between COVID, the writer's strike. You have a boom and a pullback on streaming spending. You know, if you give me your diagnostic view of Hollywood today, what are the other problems that we need to solve as we're fixing problems out there?
I mean, you sort of described the big bulk of them, right? There was a boom and then there's a rapid contraction that I think was probably accelerated a little bit by the strike. I think that AI remains an ongoing conversation and debate on a lot of fronts. I think that my fundamental thing about the industry is, other than writers are undervalued, and if you did a better job of finding good writers, you would unlock a lot of value. I think there's a similar question about diversity. I think people think about diversity only in terms of like a moral or an ethical imperative. And I think that's probably true because the stories that we tell define the lived reality of people around the world. But let's just put it in pure monetary terms, right? Like your audience is pretty diverse. So making content for a diverse audience probably necessitates making diverse content. Hollywood is losing on average $10 billion annually just because of anti-Black bias, another 18 because of anti-Latinx bias, and between 2 and 4 because of anti-Asian American bias. And so again, for me, it's like, look, put aside the moral and ethical imperative. Let's get this money by making sure that all the talented people that are out there have an opportunity to help us make money. And then the last thing I'd say is that there's just a lot of conventional wisdom in Hollywood that is all convention and no wisdom. There's a lot of things that are just sort of taken as law that have no data-driven basis at all.
Yeah, what's an example of that, Franklin?
Female-driven action movies don't work. When you bring in a female-driven action movie, you would be told, yeah, the writing's good, or this is a really good novel, but female-driven action doesn't work, Franklin. Everybody knows that. There's no evidence for that. Like, James Cameron has made a mighty successful career financially for making female-driven action. The first Terminator movie is a female-driven action movie. Titanic is a female-driven action movie, right? Another great example is Black movies aren't successful overseas. And it's like, okay, well, where are the numbers on that? Because Coming to America made a couple $100 million foreign in the 80s. You know, Denzel and Will Smith were, for a time, the two biggest movie stars in the world. You would have to believe that, like, all around the world, people are listening to hip-hop. They're watching Black athletes, but somehow when it comes to movies, people don't want to see Black people on screen. Like, it just doesn't even pass the smell test if you think about it. And my attitude about all of this is, look, you want me to believe something like that? Show me the numbers.
That makes total sense, Franklin. You mentioned something in there I didn't want to lose the thread on, which was AI, obviously a huge topic in the writer's strike. Give me your thoughts on how this plays out over the next several years in terms of impact on writers' room, writers, you know, how should we think about this?
Well, I think anybody who tries to tell you they know exactly what's going to happen in AI on any timeline is lying to you. What I would say is that there are a lot of very thorny issues, particularly as it applies to cultural products. So the first one is rights, right? There's a rights issue that just needs to be discussed in terms of like what AI has been trained on, who has the rights to that material, and can a large language model produce new material, scare quotes intended, based on other people's IP without having to compensate them for it? So that's one. Two is AI capable of writing things of the quality of a human? And I think the answer is probably yes. I think that AI can probably generate mediocre storytelling of the same sort that a mediocre writer can. I don't think, however, that AI is going to deliver us great work. And I think that if anything, it demands that the industry continue the process of curating and identifying great work that speaks to human emotions even more effectively and efficiently than it has historically. And I think fundamentally, that's not what AI does. It is a remix of a previous thing. But again, I have a great deal of faith in artists making art. And what excites me is the best of that art. And so, you know, to the extent that AI can be used as a tool of artists in service of artists, to the extent that we can use AI to support artists doing their art, I'm intrigued. When we start talking about, oh, by using AI, we can not need artists, you start to sound like an idiot to me, because that's where the value is.
Well, and it's interesting. We had a Salim Ismail on last season, who's an AI futurist, and he was making the point that it doesn't make, for example, a software engineer obsolete. It just makes them more efficient. If it can be a tool, that's one thing. If it's to me, the world in which it's a substitute, I'm personally skeptical of, and I guess hopefully skeptical of. We'll see. Before, Franklin, I move to the last part of the segment of the pod, I want to do a quick speed round of questions for you. I'm going to ask you some quick questions. You give me a quick answer. First thought, best thought. All right. What movie have you watched the most in your life?
It might be Jurassic Park.
Amazing. Good answer, by the way. Last great movie you watched?
I mean, I'm just coming off of the Telluride and Toronto Film Festival, so there are like a bunch of them. There's this movie September 5th that I saw at Telluride that is very, very strong. It'll be coming out this fall. I highly recommend it.
What's the Blacklist script recently that you're most excited to see on a screen?
So if anybody follows me on social media, they know I'm a degenerate soccer fan. And there was a Didier Drogba biopic on the Blacklist a couple of years ago. And I don't know if I necessarily want to see that script specifically, but I want to see a great soccer movie. And I think the great soccer movie is likely to have Africa as a substantial backdrop.
All right. What is your favorite snack at a movie theater?
I'm just going to go regular popcorn. Popcorn or Red Vines would be the other one.
All good answers. What's your cocktail of choice on a Friday night after a long and busy week, Franklin?
I'm an old-fashioned drinker, just straight whiskey neat.
There we go. If you had to live in one city other than Los Angeles, what would it be?
I love London. My wife's from there. That's probably the go-to, but it's also like I can wrap my head around what that would actually look like. I also really love Copenhagen.
It's a great city. All right, you brought it up. Favorite club soccer team?
So I'm a true neutral. I'm going to say LAFC because I have season tickets and they're my local, but like I'm a true neutral. Someone recently described me as a petty bitch who loves drama, and that's definitely true when it comes to soccer.
How far will the U.S. men's national team make it in the next World Cup?
Round of 16.
I mean, I'd take it. All right. Always fascinating to hear what you're up to. Appreciate your participation in the speed round, Franklin. With that, I want to move to the last segment of the pod, something we call best ideas. We like to offer up something that's added value in our lives recently, best ideas, because it's our goal as investors to maximize exposure to those. Franklin, you're our guest. I'm going to ask you to go first. What is your best idea this week?
So this is stupid, and it's frustrating that it's such a good idea because I find it really painful, but like exercise. I'm in my mid-40s. I just need to take every opportunity to remind myself that as much as I hate it, it is a very good thing and it is worth it.
I love it. I support that best idea wholeheartedly. All right, then for my best idea, as people know, I like to be inspired by the guest of the week. Franklin has made a career of shining a light on creative works that are underappreciated. And so I spent some time looking at a tallying of blacklist scripts that actually got made. There are many, as discussed previously, that you all will know incredibly well. But out of respect for someone who loves finding a diamond in the rough, I wanted to recommend a blacklisted movie that flew a little below the radar and I thought was fantastic. My best idea this week is the movie They Cloned Tyrone, streaming on Netflix. The script, written by Jewel Taylor and Tony Rettenmeyer, it appeared in the blacklist in 2019, was bought and released as a feature film in theaters and on Netflix in 2023. They Cloned Tyrone defies description. Most reviews say something to the effect of, it's genre bending. I might describe it as a thrilling sci-fi twist on 70s blaxploitation films. The cast is stacked. John Boyega, Tayona Paris, Jamie Foxx are the three leads. And there's several small roles that are filled by really well-known actors that I won't spoil for you. So, in honor of a man who spends his life turning over stones to find things you wouldn't expect, this movie, which 100% defies easy categorization, seemed like the perfect best idea. So the best idea this week then, the remarkable They Cloned Tyrone on Netflix. Franklin, your take on that movie?
Yeah, that's an excellent, good idea. I think your description of it is perfect. There's really no way to prepare people for what they're about to see.
All right, Franklin, with that, it's time to wrap up for the week. Greatly appreciate you taking your time. We look forward to hearing more of great things from the Blacklist in the years to come. And thanks for coming on today.
My pleasure.
Thanks again to our guest, Franklin Leonard. Check out our show notes to learn more about Franklin and the Blacklist. There, you'll also find a link to watch my best idea, the 2023 movie They Cloned Tyrone, streaming on Netflix. This podcast was brought to you by At Will Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. The opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host, Colbert Cannon, and the guest of each episode, and do not necessarily reflect the views of HPS Investment Partners.